Financial technology, or fintech, is one of the fastest growing industries in the world today, with New York, London, Tel Aviv, Edinburgh, Singapore, Moscow, and other major cities all vying for a piece of the action. Welcome to Breaking Banks, the first dedicated radio show that focuses on how this new boom is changing everything from the way we bank to the very concept of money itself. Now, here's your host, Brett King.
Welcome back to Breaking Banks. I am Brett King, your host, and with me in the studio today is Penny Crosman. Welcome back, Penny.
Thank you.
It's been a little while since you've been on the show.
That's right.
So we also have joining us from, West Coast is Jason Henricks. We're joined in the studio by Penny today. We're at the American and Banker Source Media Studios in downtown New York City, One State Street. And also in the studio is Samir Chisti. He's going to be talking to us soon about what's happening in Hong Kong and with the fintech scene there. And later in the show, we'll hear from Neil Grover, the founder and CEO of Indie.com and the former CEO of Rakuten, Bluefly, Buy.com. Really interesting. You're going to find that interesting, Samir. And also, we'll hear from my good pal, Bob Bassani, who is the global markets reporter for CNBC. He's going to be talking to us about how blockchain and Bitcoin, artificial intelligence and stuff like that is changing the global market. So really, really interesting interview. Breaking Banks is brought to you this week by our friends at Source Media and American Banker, our long-term partners that syndicate Breaking Banks across the United States and also graciously provide us with studio space for our live shows.
Well, Brett, I would also like to get them to build me a nice studio in Chicago, and I'm going to insist every show that we re-record that opener until you include Chicago in that list. Just, you know, be advised.
Look, I think we can do it. We'll have to include Seattle, though,
Well, now Marusha's going to want Cleveland included, and it's all gone to hell. Yeah. So this show is also brought to you by Medici, formerly known as Let's Talk Payments, and they provide solutions to the world's leading banks, insurance companies, and fintech startups to help them maximize the return on their innovation investments. Medici partnered with our friends at FedFiz, the bank data specialist, to create a new solution, the FI Data Pack. Now, I've had a chance to look at what's in this data pack, and I've got to say I was blown away at the quality of the data, the proprietary ratings, and the context on actually who is actually integrated with whom. It's actually a great data set to look at. And if you use the code PROVOKE, you receive a great discount when you go to gomedici.com/breakingbanks.
There you go. Well, so the partnerships continue to be critical for us in respect to distribution, but also conference announcements coming up. We have American Bankers Digital Banking Conference in Austin, Texas on June 6th through 8th. There's going to be over 650 senior-level executives from financial institutions, credit unions, and solution providers from around the world speaking there. It's called Digital Banking 2017. 2018. It is 2018. And then,
it is 2018.
Yeah, it is. And a ton of our hosts and regular guests will be speaking there. Theo Lau, Theodora, will be there. Ron Shevlin's going to be there. Brad Limer, and yours truly. Jason, are you going to be there?
I am not going to be there. I have a little bit of a conflict going on because it is an active time that we're setting up in the Midwest with. First, Ron's going to be going from Austin to Minneapolis to keynote the Analytics and Financial Innovation Conference, June 10th to 12th. And then I'm pleased to announce, actually, it just went live today, active time in the Midwest, that FinTechs, where I'm the chairman, will be hosting a new series called The Forum, June 11th to 14th. And this is a little bit like the anti-conference, not an unconference, which I actually hate when you show up and there's no agenda. But as the conference scene has exploded with commercially run programs that emphasize number of participants over content, this is a very different approach. This is an invite-only, highly curated set of intimate sessions around topics such as building a fintech cluster, the ROI of AI, cyber security, and the ever-sexy Dodd-Frank. We'll also be live taping an episode of Breaking Banks with Mike Ventura on his new book, Applied Empathy. And if you're a listener somewhere around the U.S. or the world or in the Midwest, send me a direct message on Twitter at Jason Henricks, and I might be able to hook you up there.
Mike's brother is an ace, is it?
I hope not. Not the empathy we're looking for.
Yeah. So Jim Morales will be keynoting the FinTech Generations Conference in Charlotte, North Carolina on June 13th. And don't forget also that June 6th to 13th in London is FinTech Week. So that's where the world of FinTech comes to what is, you know, by some measure, becoming the world's FinTech capital to enhance the dialogue between established multinationals, innovation firms, disruptive startups, governments, media, and investors.
Now, I can't believe I'm going to say this, that we're even announcing a conference that is October 8th to 10th, but early bird sales of Lend 360 end June 8th. So if you want to save 25% off on your ticket to Lend 360, get your butt in gear in the next 2 weeks. And if you use the code FinTech, you get an additional 10% off. If you have something you want to share with our audience, either as a conference or a news item, feel free to hit us up on Twitter at BreakingBanks1. Or email us at info@provoke.fm.
Okay, so in the news this week, we had some big news. PayPal made a big acquisition. Penny, tell us about what happened with PayPal's acquisition of iZettle.
Well, iZettle is a kind of a competitor to PayPal, mostly in Europe and in Latin America. They operate in 12 markets, and they have kind of a similar card swiping or chip device, card reader, and software for merchants. They have acceptance at 500,000 merchants in those markets. So, you know, PayPal has announced its intentions to go international and really broaden its whole market, and it's really making a strong push in merchant acceptance. So, you know, I think analysts thought the $2.2 billion was a high price for them to pay, but it does seem like this is kind of key to their strategy currently. And, you know, it makes a lot of sense. I mean, I think also, you know, we saw the bank's answer to Venmo, Zelle, really escalate. Like at the end of last year, P2P payments on their network kind of surpassed Venmo. So it's like PayPal is picking the spot of going through merchants and getting payments, kind of locking in the merchant market as kind of its path forward and its path to growth. So yeah, so it would be you know, more of a challenge to Square, which Square also has intentions of becoming more international and especially going into the UK market. And Zettle is very strong in the UK market. So,
in fact, iZettle was sort of considered the Square of Europe for a while because they formed not long after Square launched in the US, and they were sort of seen as a bit of a Square clone. But clearly, their business has grown well beyond that.
Right, right. They offer more of a what you call multi-channel or omni-channel technology. So, yeah, it's be interesting to see how they do with that.
What else you got for us in the news?
Well, one thing that I thought was interesting was the news that Coinbase and Ivy Coin are both trying to apply for U.S. bank charters. It's something that's traditionally really, really difficult to do.
Yeah.
You know, Coinbase really wants to become a full-fledged financial services provider. You know, they started as a digital wallet, and now they have a custody product for institutions. And they're really trying to become kind of more closer to a bank for consumers and businesses that invest in digital currencies.
Yeah.
So, you know, it makes sense for them. And they've had talks with the OCC. The OCC won't comment on, you know, how likely they are to get this charter. You know, some observers say it's going to be extremely hard for them to actually get a charter because, you know, the regulators, you know, do intense scrutiny when anybody wants to get
I'm not going to say anything about
charter.
That, but I'm well aware of it.
So now Ivy Coin it's kind of interesting because they're not as far along. They're talking with the FDIC. They have not actually applied for a bank charter yet, but they have technology that where they want to be kind of a bridge between the digital currency world and the fiat currency world, especially for financial institutions. That's where they're starting, trying to give financial institutions the technology to be able to handle crypto clients in a compliant way. So deal with all of the anti-money laundering and Bank Secrecy Act and related, you know, regulations.
Well, that they have. So would they'd be the first bank in the U.S. that actually does crypto custody? if they were to get the license, right?
I believe that's correct. Yeah. There are banks that bank crypto companies, but I don't know if anybody
doing
actually
custody of
doing
crypto.
Custody.
I think it's going to be a hard one right now, not because they're not deserving and not doing really interesting things and actually bringing some of this around the AML and KYC into the light, but I'm just not sure the regulators are ready to make a comment yet. And certainly granting a charter, you know, is really sending a comment in terms of where things are headed. So I think right idea headed in the right direction, but politically difficult to pull off right now. And so, you know, on that topic, you know, ICOs continue to be hot. And by hot, I mean hot for scamming. It seems that some retail investors didn't see Colbert's special. Did you guys see that a couple of months ago when he got on to explain?
Colbert or Oliver? John Oliver.
Oh, you're right. It was Oliver. Colbert has one as well, but Oliver.
That John Oliver was on, and of course, Brock Pierce, our good friend, was highlighted on that.
Yeah.
That was,
so. Well, it seems that people are still falling for the scams they find on Twitter, getting promoted like the ripoff Twitter account that was spamming, pretending to be breaking banks. Well, the SEC decided it was time for some hands-on education and created a scam ICO of their own to show investors what they were falling for. And ironically, it was called the Howie Coin. And if people don't know what's funny about that, it's really a double entendre. Is the Howie test is what the SEC uses to determine whether an investment is a security and therefore they should be regulating it. So if you haven't gotten the message yet, whether it's by comedians or breaking banks or the SEC, you shouldn't be buying securities you see only advertised on Twitter by people you don't really know.
Yeah. All right. Well, on that note, what's interesting is we did see a donation of $4 million in XRP, which of course is Ripple's coin, to Ellen's Wildlife Fund by Ashton Kutcher. Did you see that, Penny?
I saw a headline about that. Yeah, that's wild.
It just seems to me like a bit of a PR exercise. I mean, yeah, you know, XRP's done pretty well, but... Yeah.
Nice for Ripple to get that kind of publicity.
But Ashton's, of course, been very big on this stuff. But anyway, well, listen, let's move straight into our next guest. So Samir Chisti is visiting from Hong Kong, and we're very grateful. Thanks, Penny, for stepping in on the news too. And Samir, he previously led Bain & Company's FIG practice for Greater China. He was part of the Standard Chartered team a few years ago, hailed from New York for many years. So visiting New York again, now lives in Hong Kong. He's a venture partner for Spark Labs, a global accelerator, an Asia-Pac investments focus on leveraging off China's Belt and Road Initiative. So, Samir, welcome to New York.
It's great to be back. What a beautiful day to be here.
What brings what brings you to New York this time?
You know, New York, I mean, the immediate...
You can do a bit of a humble brag, dude.
Well, the immediate reason is my 25th college reunion starts tomorrow in Boston.
Who's your college?
Well, it is Harvard. It's Harvard University. Yeah, exactly. Thank you for letting me drop the H-bomb publicly and with permission. So I thought it's always good to be spending a few days in New York. I think New York and San Francisco still are intellectual powerhouses in fintech, especially. And it's great to interact with guys like
and
you.
And the weather is amazing today, right? It's like 86 degrees.
I just wish the Yankees were in town.
There you go. So let me ask you, from a perspective of what's happening out in China, tell me about where you think, China is going with the Belt and Road. You've talked about, it's in your profile, you're investing side by side with this, but what makes the Belt and Road a big deal? Because a lot of people that if they're listening to this from the EU or from the States, they probably not familiar with the extensive investment that China is making right now.
Yeah, Brett, that's spot on. The Belt and Road program is the biggest thing happening in the world today that people don't know about. If you live in China or if you live in one of the countries into which China is getting better connected, you know exactly what Belt and Road is, but sad that people in America don't know. So let me give you a 2-minute intro, and then I'm sure there are other sources people can go to. The Belt and Road Initiative is tens of billions of dollars that China is investing in debt and equity into markets around the world, typically emerging markets like Pakistan, Malaysia, Ethiopia. And what these folks, and let me make it real by giving one specific example of a country, Pakistan, where we're deeply involved. Now, most Americans don't know what Pakistan is, where it is. They're probably seeing it in the news. Pakistan's the world's sixth biggest population, and it's proximate to China. And what China's doing is spending $62 billion building a port, building roads, building energy sources, essentially infrastructure to upgrade the country. And with that, as you can imagine, come benefits such as alliances, partnerships, and so on, and a pathway for a globalization of the RMB. So we're obviously super excited about it. It's an opportunity to for more trade, for more investment opportunities in Pakistan. We, on the infrastructure side, we are co-investors in a few projects in transport, financial services, energy, more to come. And on the technology side, you know, your friend Jack Ma this year has put in $300 million of equity into Pakistan in two.
$300 million
wow. into two projects. One is he bought a 40 and financial bought 45% of the, let's say, the Paytm of Pakistan.
What's it called? The Paytm of Pakistan? It's not Paytm.
Right? It is a bank run by the telecom company. It's called Telenor Bank. The retail brand name is Easy Paisa, which means easy money.
Yeah,
it's a payment company that's progressing. And
are they involved with M-Pesa at all? Is it a Vodafone thing?
No, it's not. It's a Telenor thing. It's a Telenor, the big Norwegian telecom mobile network operator. And these guys, I think, frankly, have taken the M-Pesa product into a whole different place.
Yeah.
You know, full disclosure, I was involved with them as an advisor. So full disclosure on that. But they've developed a fantastic program of physical points of presence. I think they've got about 55,000. They've got 30,000 biometric devices. But we still think there's room to grow, even in Pakistan, meaning it's 200 million people, north of 200 million people, 90 million mobile phones, only 15 million bank accounts. So we still think there's lots more to do.
It's like, as I said before the show, it's like that story of the shoe salesman that gets off the plane in Africa, and there's two of them, and one says, "Hey, no one wears shoes here, I'm coming home." And the other says, "Send everything you've got."
That's exactly right. Yeah. The glasses half full. We think Pakistan's one of the most attractive opportunities for fintech in the world today. Even the 15 million people who are banked are underbanked. The insurance rates are low, savings rates, investment rates are low. Savings rates are actually good. Investment rates are low. So that's Jack Ma's one bet through Ant Financial. The other one is he bought the Amazon of Pakistan from Rocket Internet. So those are roughly $300 million bets. In fact, our venture capital company, where I'm a venture partner, Spark Labs Global, which is the world's third biggest early stage tech investor, with the accelerators and funds around the Pacific Rim. We're based in, we have a fintech accelerator in Shenzhen in partnership with Ping An Group, which is a fantastic partner. And we are looking for startups along the Belt and Road, because why would you not?
Right, of course, yeah.
Jessica?
Yeah, well, I'm curious because, you know, you have a, call it the second mover, third mover, maybe down to the fourth mover advantage, right, of you have a chance to start with this clean slate and what you're developing. Do you think a lot of the strategies are going to be just updated versions of the products that we've gotten used to in the West, or is this a completely blank slate? Let's start and take advantage of what's happened. Because one of the problems we have right now is our infrastructure is good enough, so it can be difficult to replace. And it's actually in a lot of the developing countries that I think they're going to leap ahead of us.
Yeah.
So on that, you know, right now there's a strategy in the US to sort of, yeah, forget globalization. Let's focus on the U.S. And, you know, we obviously know infrastructure is a sore point here. You know, there's a lot of infrastructure development. But how does this set China up for the next 20, 30 years in terms of competitiveness as an economy?
You know, I've got a unique perspective on this, obviously, as an infrastructure investor in Belt and Road and as a technology investor in China. Plus, having spent a large part of my life in the U.S. and in China, I feel I've got a more holistic view of this. Once again, there are other people who understand this stuff. What I see is a few things. One is, China is a lot bigger than anyone realizes, and it is actually expanding outside China in a peaceful way, connecting economically, financially, trade infrastructure.
Economic colonialism.
Well, I don't think it's colonialism. I think it's actually benign. It's building trade routes, routes, corridors, laying down new rails of the New World Order. And therein lies the... So you could have made this a collaborative, positive effect, except at the exactly the wrong time, the U.S. seems to be pulling out.
Right.
They seem to be withdrawing. That's a big problem
creating
for everyone.
Creating a vacuum.
Exactly, because frankly, the U.S. has a lot to offer the world. So far, so good, right? Okay, so China's going to do a lot more that I think is good. The issue that I have with the U.S. is frankly, it's a combination of ignorance and incompetence. Is that I don't think the U.S. fully understands, the current policymakers don't fully understand what China is, what China's trying to do, and frankly, what China's partners are trying to do, who some of them used to be the U.S.'s partners, and the U.S. is forfeiting that. Second is the U.S., current U.S. team seems to know the price of everything, the value of nothing, and they've changed this, they've taken this multilateral world that the U.S. helped create and frankly benefits from, and converted this to a series of bilateral discussions, single game bilateral discussions, which is frankly dangerous for the U.S. place in the world.
Yeah, I agree.
And more countries are aligning better with China. Frankly, I made a joke 2 years ago, which actually I think may actually come out to be true, that the U.S. should be the next stop on the Belt and Road. The U.S. could use a few hundred billion dollars of infrastructure.
Well, we'll see how that goes. They are investing in Trump real estate, apparently. But
that's right here.
All right, I won't get into that. Okay, so Samir, look, I want to go to our next guest, but before I do that, where can people find out a little bit more about your ventures and what you're doing?
Our infrastructure parks and stuff, we don't like talking about too much, right. But Spark Labs FinTech, Spark Labs group, we're on Twitter, we're on all the social media.
Sparklabs.io, is it? Or
I should know this. Yeah, I don't. I apologize. Right. Spark Labs FinTech, just
we'll
Twitter.
We'll find it out. Yes. And we'll tweet it out for the listeners. So appreciate that. But thanks for joining us, and thanks for coming all the way from Hong Kong to have a chat with us. Up now is Neil Grover. Neil is a seasoned e-commerce leader. Some of you have probably heard of him. He leads teams around the world that have sold $5 billion online. He's run the third largest marketplace in the United States with over 20 million products, 7,000 retailers, as well as a top fashion marketplace with over 1,000 brands. While at Buy.com, he took the venture from losing almost $100 million a year to 13 consecutive profitable quarters. But his latest venture, Indie.com, is focused on helping make brands more relevant and engaging the millennial and Gen Z crowds who increasingly engage via video and word of mouth fueled by social media. So please join me in welcoming Neil Grover to the show. Neil.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
No, I really appreciate you coming on. So before we get started on Indie.com, can you tell us what was your first major successful venture?
It would have been Buy.com. I was fortunate to go into the company, fortunate or unfortunate, to go into the company when it was losing $100 million a year. We had just taken the company private in the internet downturn, where it had seen a peak of a $6 billion market cap and a low of a low $20 million market cap. We took the company private. It was competing with Amazon on every single SKU and having a tough go at it. And we really changed the model completely. Created a marketplace, brought on, as you mentioned, 7,000 other brands as big as, at the time, Toys R Us to smaller mom and pops. And whereas Amazon obviously had done really well with their marketplace, our main pitch to them was, look, we're going to treat you better. We're going to be your partner. We're not going to sell that same product that, that you sell. And we didn't sell any products directly ourselves. And we're just going to focus on growing your business. And we ultimately, created some great partnerships, built a white label marketplace for Best Buy, and grew the business to 13 consecutive profitable quarters, and close to $1 billion in revenue. Ultimately sold the company to Rakuten out of Japan, which is one of the top five largest e-commerce companies. And then I ran Rakuten North America for a few years thereafter.
So Buy.com, is it still under the Buy.com brand, or is it in Rakuten now?
No, it's now fully called Rakuten.com. It was Buy.com, then Buy.com, a Rakuten company, and now Rakuten.com.
I should have known that, but I didn't have time to look it up beforehand. So
no problem.
Now you're now using your skills in terms of understanding how to grow a business in the digital age to build this new engagement platform, Indie.com. Now, as I understand it, you guys are a video engagement platform. You do brand marketing services for a range of different brands, right?
We do. And really what helped us a lot when we were competing with Amazon was we had a great set of customers that would tell their friends about us. And, it really goes back to retail 101. If you deliver a good product or service, you want your customers to tell their friends and other coworkers about how great it is rather than you having to always do the advertising and marketing yourself. And so what we did is really digitize that in today's age and really utilizing the benefits of social media and customers. Where today they're actually being limited on how much they can communicate with you in social, we create tools that really incentivize your customers to talk about you authentically and organically, therefore getting the word out about your brand.
Great. So, listen, we're obviously now in this era of, you know, massive YouTube and Insta stars, you know, PewDiePie, H3H3, Logan Paul and others. But, you know, given that you're deep into this, what role does video play in creating brands and engaging with customers today? How important is video?
I think video is really important. I think, you know, traditionally it's been the brand wanting to control that message and control that that video. I think where it gets even better and can take you to new stratospheric levels is when your customers create what they believe your brand is or what it is to them. Hopefully that's completely aligned with what you're saying and thinking. But then they can create their own vision of it. And that can get so much more viral than anything you create as a brand itself. And I think that's where you really can accelerate the growth of a company today.
Mm. So if I'm an entrepreneur getting started today, you know, how would you suggest I use video to make a mark?
Well, where would you start? Basically start with your own. Yeah, I mean, still probably best to create your own video content to start and start creating that message of what your brand is, who your brand is, so your customers and potential customers can really get a feel of who you are authentically and organically. But thereafter, it's really about engaging them. One of the big things that we're trying to help solve for is, you know, over the last few years, every brand was really happy to engage and interact with their customer on social media. You bought something from me, you came in, had a great service experience with me, I'd ask you to go like me or follow me or you know, engage in some kind of a post on social media, maybe even upload some, you know, a photo or a review of it. The problem with that now is the game has changed pretty dramatically. Over the last few years, you had a free flow of communication between the brand and their customer on social media with very little friction. But in the last several weeks, you know, really announced a couple months ago, Facebook especially changed the game. And whereas brands would, you know, if you had millions and millions and millions of followers, those followers would see your posts. Anything you posted to your brand pages would get shown up in their social feeds. But that has changed dramatically now, where brands are really having less than 1% engagement on social media now. And so really in the last few weeks, I like to say that brands are now renting their engagement. I mean, they've always really been renting it, but now it's really owned by social media. And so if you wanted to pack up shop and leave, you don't have any of those millions of customers' email addresses or contact information. You don't get any of the content that they upload. You don't get any of the data that's happening around that engagement. And so what we're providing brands is the ability to interact and engage with your customer back on your own website or on Indy, where we host it for you, but it can be fully embedded in your site. And then you ask your customers after they purchase from you or interact with you to create some kind of content. Starbucks recently gave away close to $1 million asking their customers which charities should they donate to. And so they engaged their fan base or customer base, got them to create content around the videos, got around the charities that they believed in, and they were incentivized to share that throughout their social networks. And as they did that, that is not blocked by the algorithms of Facebook or Instagram, et cetera. And it pushes out subtly Starbucks' brand, but also helped all of those charities. And so it's a way to really utilize your customer to drive their social awareness and social feeds to elevate your brand and further connect you and engage you with your customer.
Okay, well, let's. How can people find out more about Indy.com and the services you guys provide?
Yes, they just go to www.indy, and that's INDI.com. Any brand can come on and create a channel and turn their customers into performance-based word-of-mouth advertisers.
Fantastic. Unfortunately, we don't have much more time left today, but I'd love to hear your thoughts some stage on how fintechs can use video to grow and scale. So that's maybe for next time.
Absolutely. Sounds great. Thanks a lot.
Great.
Just as the data around your social media can be a challenge, within financial services, getting access to the high quality financial data that you need to build enterprise ready products is a challenge, something that the nonprofit FinTech Sandbox has solved. And what they do is provide startups free access to products from over 37 market data providers. Their six-month program includes data access, development resources, and connection with a curated network of financial professionals. Institutions looking to explore financial technologies find rigorously selected startups and a structure for innovation through the FinTech Sandbox. Get free data and start exploring at fintechsandbox.org. And after the break, who will we have up next, Brett?
We are going to be talking to our good friend Bob Pisani from CNBC. So we'll be right back with you guys after this break.
Become our friend on Facebook. Post your thoughts about our shows and network on our timeline. Visit Facebook.com/Voice America.
Now, before we get back to talking about fintech, I want to take a quick moment to tell you about eFinancialCareers.com, one of the supporters of the show. They're the world's leading career site for financial service professionals for over 15 years. eFinancialCareers.com partners with leading financial and fintech firms, so your resume is seen by all the top companies and recruiters in the US and abroad. Now, as we all know, financial services is a very dynamic, ever-changing industry, and eFinancial Careers provides valuable resources from helpful career coaching to interview strategies and tools that keep you up to speed and well-informed with what's happening now in the industry and what it means for your career. Registration's free for financial professionals. Make sure you take advantage of all the resources they have to offer. So check them out, eFinancialCareers.com.
You're listening to Breaking Banks, featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or join the conversation on Twitter by using the hashtag Breaking Banks. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back to Breaking Banks. I'm Brett King, and I'm with Jason Henricks. We're hosting this week. Breaking Banks is supported by our good friends Marshall Cavendish, publishers out of Singapore, a global publisher. They are also publishers of major fintech tomes such as Digital Bank from Chris Skinner, Digital Human, Bank 4.0, which is due out in August, and many more. But now, earlier in the week, I caught up with CNBC's global market analyst, Bob Pisani, on how he thinks blockchain, crypto, and fintech players are changing the shape of global markets and why he thinks we need more IPOs, not ICOs. I'm with Bob Pisani, who has been with CNBC for a very long time as their global market stock consultant. And we're very pleased to have him on the show today. Bob, welcome to Breaking Banks.
Thanks, Brett. It's my 28th year at CNBC and my 21st year as the stocks correspondent. So I've been around for a while.
So how did you get started in that? Let's get the origin story.
Well, my family was in the real estate business for a long time. And my father and I in the late 1980s taught a course on real estate development at the Wharton School, a single course. So we were adjuncts. By sheer dumb luck, we wrote a book on fundamentals of real estate in 1989. Came out the month CNBC went on the air in April 89.
Oh, wow.
And a friend of mine was a producer, called me up and said, "What are you doing?" I said, "Well, I'm teaching real estate and got a book out on real estate development." She said, "Well, we're starting this new network called CNBC. It's about financial stuff. Why don't you come on as a guest?" So I was on as a guest and had me on a bunch of times. And in the end of the first year in 1990, they hired me as the real estate correspondent. In 1997, I became the stocks correspondent.
So, the markets have been pretty insane the last couple of years, obviously going up. You know, you've had some record numbers at the Dow and so forth that you've been reporting on. But there are some structural changes taking place globally around digital that we're very interested in at the show. So I'm interested, first of all, let's start with your take on, what's happening in terms of blockchain and cryptocurrencies, Bitcoin, that sort of stuff. What's your take on these as technologies? Do you see them as, influential? Do you see them as drivers? What's your take?
Well, I think like a lot of people, certainly a lot of people in the financial area, I was a skeptic. Up until about 2 years ago, I think my personal viewpoint was pretty much the consensus that it was not a proven technology and Bitcoin wasn't real. And I'll tell you what sort of changed my mind. About 2 years ago, there was an uptick in investments, and we sort of follow where the money is going, particularly private investments. And there was an uptick of investment about 2 years ago in blockchain. And then we just started getting more emails. Now, I pay a lot of attention to viewer emails. And all of a sudden, out of nowhere, beginning about 2 years ago, the email started getting more noticeable, and it got bigger and bigger through 2016. And then into 2017, it just really exploded. And I mean, Brett, I haven't seen emails like this since, well, probably since the dot-com era in 2000. It was really high. And that, when I saw that 2 years ago starting to happen, the investment started picking up and the email interest started picking up. We started talking about it at CNBC and what was the proper level of coverage. And I started looking into it a lot more detailed, called my friends on Wall Street. This was when they were producing very, very big sort of what you might call white papers on Wall Street, you know, 60, 70, 80 page papers explaining the technology behind blockchain and altcoins and Bitcoin. And I read four or five of them, talked to some people over a period of a few months, a couple of years ago, and I changed my opinion. I came to understand that blockchain was a potentially disruptive technology. And I had spent a lot of time looking at other disruptive technologies like artificial intelligence, genomics, robotics, nanotechnology. And I realized that it actually can potentially fit into that sort of disruption. By disruption, I mean these technologies force companies to alter the way they approach their business. If they don't, if they ignore it, down the road they could risk losing market share or they could risk becoming irrelevant. And I sort of changed my mind on that. We can get into what areas I think are worthwhile and what areas I think are not, but I saw the potential there.
Now, you know, would you classify, you know, Bitcoin specifically? Do you see that as a cryptocurrency? Do you see that as a payments network? Do you see it as an application on blockchain, or do you see it as has it just become an asset class?
Well, Bitcoin itself, there is a problem with Bitcoin. The way it looks like it was originally created, it was a medium of exchange. It meant to solve the problem. How can I transfer money from me to you without having a bank involved or some intermediary? And that was a great idea, but it hasn't evolved that way. Nobody uses Bitcoin to pay for pizzas, for example. What has happened instead is Bitcoin has evolved as a store of value, as an investment. And part of the reason this has happened is because there is no real way to invest in blockchain right now, at least no easy way. And that's a problem. Because of that, people buy Bitcoin as a proxy for investing in blockchain. And I think that's probably a mistake. What I think is necessary, what we need to see is more blockchain technologies going public and becoming investable. For example, I think Ripple or Ethereum, Coinbase should find ways to go public. Right now, there are exchange traded funds that claim that they are blockchain exchange traded funds, that you can buy companies that are invested in blockchain technology, but that's all a lot of nonsense. Most of the time, these companies have almost no revenue stream from blockchain technology. They just don't. So we need to have an infrastructure where people can invest in it. And then I think investing in Bitcoin as a front for investing in the blockchain will sort of become less relevant. Now, if that means Bitcoin's price goes down, fine. I don't have any investment in, you know, what the price of Bitcoin is. I'm interested in the blockchain.
So on that, you know, we recently saw Kodak announce that they were going to do a blockchain, and we had a spike in their stock price. Can you sort of explain the rationale behind that?
Well, yeah. I don't want to get too much into Kodak. I can tell you there's a problem with this whole thing, and that is, to a certain extent, about it has to do with initial coin offerings. So the SEC is, if you look at the barriers for deeper adoption of this technology, number one is there's centralized incumbents out there like MasterCard and Visa and American Express. Number two, there's security issues. And number three, there's regulation issues. And I think regulation is a major problem. In fact, oftentimes when you see Bitcoin go down in price, it's because of regulatory issues. Bitcoin was down recently, for example, on regulatory concerns. So the SEC, the Securities Exchange Commission, views its core mission as protecting investors from fraud. And they take that very, very seriously. And they see very significant possibility for fraud in initial coin offerings. Recently, they created a fake ICO site to alert investors to what to look for with frauds, because they've seen so many of these ICOs with what they see fraudulent claims. And it was very interesting. It was very innovative on the SEC's part. They actually created a fake site. They've never done anything like that. They're also very alarmed by theft of coins from the exchanges. So the SEC believes that ICOs are securities, and that's a very important legal distinction, because if they are securities, that means the SEC can have jurisdiction over. And the term, if you're wondering what is a security, it's basically anything, any instrument that conveys some participation in a profit-sharing agreement. In other words, it's a security if you're investing in a coin to make a profit through the efforts of others. So I think that there's a real issue with these ICOs. And unfortunately, the SEC has tiptoed around this very, very carefully. Other than saying, we think almost all these coins are real securities, which means we have jurisdiction over them, they haven't exactly issued what kind of regulations and exactly explained what a company has to do to be compliant. And I think that's a major problem right now. So the SEC has made it clear they're not trying to put Bitcoin out of business, or they're not trying to put blockchain out of business. They're trying to understand the space. They don't want to end it, but number one to them is they do not want a massive fraud on their watch. Well, they say, okay, we've approved ICOs, and then it turns out to be massive fraud. They're going to try to figure out a way to minimize the impact of fraud. And unfortunately, it's still a work in progress. And that's one of the things that's really holding it back.
Yeah, and I think I agree with you firmly there. Obviously, there are real tokens and real coins out there, but you know, there has been clearly scams as well. So on the regulatory part of it, you know, you look not just obviously at US markets, although that's you're looking primarily at US markets, but you look globally. But on that front, you know, we've had different regulators respond in different ways to things like Bitcoin and blockchain and so forth. And we've just seen the US roll back some of the Dodd-Frank protections that came after the financial crisis. So when you see all of these new technologies coming into financial services, and we see, you know, billions of dollars going into the fintech space, you know, how do you assess the US has done from a regulatory perspective in terms of responding to these changes generally compared to some of the other markets?
Well, if you're talking about blockchain in general, I think the US has been fairly open. The ones perhaps that have been most open are the Japanese. And you can see what the effect of that, and until recently, the South Koreans, and you can see what that has done. So up until recently, if I look at like volumes in Bitcoin trading, for example, and today, for example, of all the global trading in Bitcoin, about half of it was done in Japan. And that's because it has a looser regulatory structure. Now, until recently, on any given day, you could look at it and you could see 20-30% of the volume being done in South Korea. Now, I'm talking about global value in terms of currency. Yep. And recently, because the South Koreans have gotten more aggressive, volume trading in Bitcoin in Korea has dropped. So today, I don't know what it was, but it's probably not more than 5% today. Yep. In the U.S., the volume was probably 30% today. So if I had to guess today, Japan was probably half of the volume in Bitcoin, and the U.S. was maybe a quarter, and you know, maybe Korea was 5%, and the rest of the world was some other smaller number. So the regulatory structure definitely influences it. Now, a lot of people will say, you know, this is a little strange here. I mean, if you're just interested in trading Bitcoin, why would the regulatory structure impact the price? And, you know, the obvious answer is some people are moving money around or trying to move money around for illegitimate purposes. I have no doubt that is true. I think it's true of
the U.S. dollar. So why wouldn't it be true of Bitcoin?
Right. That's right. We know that the $100 bill is, you know, primary purpose of the $100 bill is to move around illicit transactions. Yeah,
did you hear they discontinued circulation of the 500 euro note for that purpose? There was a story going around. They used to call the 500 euro note a bin Laden because everyone knew it exists, but you could never find them, right? Because they're all being used for money laundering. So, All right, that's a different topic. But so I'm interested in your sort of take on, you know, if you look at blockchain, you mentioned artificial intelligence as well. These are clearly a couple of technologies which are going to be really important from a structural perspective for markets moving forward. Do you think the market perceives as a sort of a structural change in the value chain and value exchange mechanisms, or is it just sort of seen as an evolution?
Well, if we're talking about blockchain, the answer is yes. It is. What's happening here is it is slowly seeping into the consciousness of first the intellectual decision makers, the people who will be out there, the JP Morgans of the world, the Goldman Sachs, the people who really raise money. If you look, and we watch private equity fundraising. If you look at the numbers, it went through the roof a little over about 2 years ago. Frankly, it wasn't even on certainly my radar until about 2016. And that's when we started noticing, because the stuff we watch, things like viewer interest, number one, and number two, investment money. Where's the money going? Mm. Went through the roof. And I think we're a bit at a tipping point. Now, you always still have people on saying the whole thing's a fraud, but anyone who has studied blockchain technology, and I spent 2 or 3 months 2 years ago, and it changed my mind when I talked to people who really mattered about what the potential was. I think that this is here to stay. But like self-driving cars, for example, now everyone thought that this was sort of an inevitable path here. And there's a little bit of bumps in the road towards self-driving car technology that we're starting to see. And it may not be, 2022 it may not be 2022 when every car is self-driving. You have to be an idiot not to see where the trend is.
Yeah.
The same thing with artificial intelligence. Now, artificial intelligence is way ahead of blockchain in terms of a meme, in terms of its overall impact, because not only is artificial technology seeping into the decision makers and the corporate level, but it's now seeped into the public consciousness, thanks to people like Elon Musk, who are warning about, AI Holocaust and robots taking over the world and Skynet descending on us. So unfortunately, it's a sort of a negative technology implication, but artificial intelligence is the leading meme for disruptive technology, followed by robotics, followed by perhaps genomics, and then nanotechnology, which is still, in terms of the public's understanding of how that operates, I think we're still in their infancy. But I believe all of these technologies are going to change the world. And frankly, I spend a lot of my time reading papers and just trying to understand it. And that's part of what this job is today. Because of these technologies, it's become much, much more difficult to cover the global markets. When I started in 1997, we covered the United States and Europe. And I remember when the Thai baht crisis hit and the Russian debt default in 1998, the Russians defaulted on their debt. It was a real crisis. And the world was a lot smaller then, though. The internet was in its infancy. It was a lot easier to understand the world. Today, I have to follow not just the U.S. stock market. I have to follow the global stock market. I have to follow German elections. I have to follow Malaysian elections. Yeah. I'm a global strategist. I'm not just a stock market guy. And these technologies are now beginning to interact with that. And it's wonderful to see, because I think this stuff is going to change the world. And I'm excited by it. But it makes it much more complicated to figure out. It turns out that increasing complexity does not decrease risk. Increasing complexity increases risk. And we saw this with the financial crisis. A lot of these financial derivatives were at the heart of some of the problems that we saw there. Well, those were tremendously complex instruments. We had a hard time understanding them.
Yeah.
So this is why I'm a big believer in artificial intelligence, to help us sort out trends, spot things that we can't spot.
So maybe let's finish up on a couple of thoughts around that. You know, you've talked about you know, the South Koreans, the Japanese. You know, we just saw Mitsubishi UFJ issue their own tokens and so forth. So, you know, you do have when it comes to things like blockchain and artificial intelligence and autonomous vehicle, a lot of money going into these fields right now, and that's quite obviously going to change. For example, you know, the makeup of some of the big companies on the stock exchange, just like we saw with the .com, we may see new companies emerge to particularly on NASDAQ, for example. But that's also going to change employment patterns and the structure of economies. How good do you think, having been through the dot-com cycle and now seeing things like AI coming into play and sort of knowing the cycle these markets take place, how well do you think the US is placed, you know, over the next 10, 15 years to respond to this, just in respect to, say, policy and employment?
I think we're in very good shape. I'll tell you the key battle line is on the regulatory front. You have to allow these technologies to develop in a way that you become a leader, but not so broadly so that all of a sudden there's massive amounts of fraud or security issues too, which is a separate but related issue. And this is a problem all over the world. And this is a problem with everything, with genetic research. You know, you shipped us here in the United States, we're going to go to Singapore and we're going to create artificial babies if you don't let us. And it's really a global problem when you're dealing with these technologies. And I would like to see a global approach. I don't think we're going to get it. So the one thing that you can count on is you'll get a regulatory playoff against each other.
Yeah.
And particularly in artificial intelligence and genomics, and I think in fintech as well. One word about disruptive technology. Brett, you've been around a long time. Remember 5, 6, 7 years ago, and young companies, including yours, were coming in, disrupting the banks and giving them, frankly, a swift kick in the ass, which they needed because they were slow dinosaurs. And everyone suddenly came in and said, you know what, we're going to disrupt these guys. They don't understand what's going on. We're going to blow them up. Well, what actually happened was the banks said, you know what, damn, these guys are good. They're right. This technology is working. And what I saw happening is not that amazing, brilliant companies came out. The actual number was fairly small, but the banks themselves essentially co-opted everybody. So it turned out all of these innovators essentially were for sale. And what I saw was giant financial companies buying the talent, essentially.
You know, we just saw PayPal acquire iZettle this week for $2.2 billion.
Yeah. That's exactly right. Now, this is very discouraging to somebody like me because in one sense, it's good for the banks to have woken up and realized what the hell is going on, you know. But on the other hand, those of us who would like to see small companies come and invest in them, I believe in IPOs. I want more small companies because I want more investors to be able to make money off these companies. The chance to do that, it doesn't happen. They get bought out immediately. Yeah. And we can debate whether that's good or bad. I personally would rather to see the companies go public and at least have investors, you know, let them grow and have investors make money. And then if they want to sell,
that could be seen as sort of a structural shift, couldn't it? You know, during the .com, IPOs were happening at such an incredible pace. But, you know, we're not getting the number of IPOs, new companies coming to market in the public forum, are we?
I'll tell you a very disturbing number. The Wilshire 5000 is essentially the entire U.S. stock market. It's a basket of all 5,000 stocks that matter in the United States that have any market capitalization that trade on the major exchanges. Right now, there's 3,400 stocks in the Wilshire 5000. Does that sound a little weird to you?
Yeah.
That's all there is. Yeah. Because the number of stocks have slowly shrunk over the years. Partly this is mergers and acquisitions.
Yeah, consolidation.
But largely it's because the stocks that have been merged or gone out of existence haven't been replaced enough by new companies.
Mm.
The IPO market essentially peaked about 2000. And it's been it's gone through periods where it's been awful or to slightly up, but it's not robust. The new head of the SEC, Jay Clayton, is very alarmed by this and said, we need to reduce some regulations. We need to make it easier for companies to go public.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I agree with that. I think that's, because if you look at it, sort of token issues, ICOs could be sort of seen as an alternative fundraising.
They are an alternative.
IPOs, yeah. Yeah.
They are an alternative, and I think they have tremendous potential. But you know, we went over this before. They have to figure out the right way to make that happen. Now, there's all sorts of potential new ways. We want people to float companies that are legitimate and have people invest in them, and that's what everybody wants. I don't care if it's on the New York Stock Exchange or the NASDAQ or it's an ICO, providing there is some control and providing it's secure and providing you protect against scamsters. And I know I keep talking about these scamsters, but believe me, it's shocking how many of them there are out there and how easily people get taken in.
All right. Well, it's some good insights, Bob. I think we're going to have to wrap it up there because we're running out of time. But let me ask you, how do people find out more about Bob Pisani and what are you working on at the moment?
Well, you can just go on the website. You can go on CNBC.com and click on my bio there, or you can look at tradertalk.cnbc.com. That's where I talk about what's going on in the markets. If people are interested in Bitcoin, for example, we have a terrific show at 5 o'clock. It's called Fast Money. It's at 5 p.m. Eastern time. And the executive producer is Max Myers, and he's done a great job covering Bitcoin. They are all over this, and they have the very best guests on, the cutting edge people who are doing Bitcoin. So if anybody's interested, I would encourage tune into Fast Money at 5 p.m. Eastern time.
Fantastic. Well, thanks for joining us on Breaking Banks, Bob. It's always great to get together and have a talk, and really enjoyed the discussion. Take care.
Thanks, Brett. Enjoyed it.
All right, guys. Well, that's it for this week on Breaking Banks. Don't forget to, if you can, leave a review on your iTunes store wherever you download the show. If you listen to it on the AM band on WVNJ 1160, tweet us out if you use Twitter, or share a favorite episode with one of your friends on social media so we can get some more coverage on that. But thanks for joining Breaking Banks this week. We will be back with you with more Breaking Banks next Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern, 12 noon Pacific time. Thanks again.
You've been listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King. Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific time, 3 p.m. Eastern time, for more of the latest in fintech news.